Dude.
Sorry I'm late. I was completely packed, and I never nap. That's the thing that I never do that. So it threw me off, like, and it was dreamless. So I woke up and I'm like, what? Why do I have 180 missed messages here? And I'm like, I've missed my fiance. I've missed you. And I'm like, oh God, I don't know what happened. But I'm here now.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for tuning in. This is our first episode of Story Trek. I'm your host, Michael Stratigakis, and with me is my co-host.
Hi, I'm Marshall Hopkins. If you are listening to this, thank you for testing us out. Thank you for listening to this. I guess just to kind of describe what we'll be doing, it's just kind of discussing Star Trek from a story perspective. I'm sure you've heard lots of other podcasts about Star Trek. This one, we kind of hope to look at some of the stories in Star Trek and kind of dissect not just what makes them good or what makes them bad, but also kind of what makes them Star Trek. Like, why is it a story that couldn't be done in any of the other sci-fi franchises that are out there?
We hope that for a lot of you, this will be interesting and insightful and provocative of discussion, because any good story should provoke a discussion, which is, you know, what Star Trek has been all about. That's been one of the things about it, is that we're talking about it here.
And sometimes even the bad stories can spark discussions too.
Yeah. Yeah. Who knows when we're going to actually delve into Sub Rosa. I mean.
Oh boy, that's going to be fun. The one I'm not looking forward to is All the Way Home. If I'm getting the title exactly right, Deep Space Nine.
Oh, the Calamarain 1, 2, 3.
yeah. That I don't. There are so many choices in that episode, not just from a story perspective, but from many perspectives that I do not understand. But yeah, so hopefully we'll be looking at those. We'll be looking at some of the great, some of the ones that we love, some of the ones that we maybe don't love so much. And hopefully, like I said, looking from a story perspective of how did these writers and these producers construct this as a story? And not just the writers and the producers, but obviously the actors, the performers, even the costumers and effects designers and makeup designers, how all of them contributed towards telling this story, and how it all successfully feels like it is one long form story in one universe, which is something that a lot of other franchises fail to do, something that you may argue that this franchise has failed to do from time to time.
Very well said. I think that one of the things we talked about, you and I, offline here, is this whole notion of the continuity of Star Trek that's been brought up recently with the titling of this recent Discovery episode, Unification 3.
Yeah, I don't want to start off from a perspective of, you know, being negative, but I felt that there were some threads to the past, but I'm not sure if those threads were earned, if that makes any sense, for Discovery. But that said, I don't want to get off on the foot of, like, you know, crapping on Discovery. Mm-hmm. There's lots of content out there for that. But that said, there shouldn't be any sacred cows. And the continuity of it felt like it was very surface, as opposed to related to some of the deeper themes related to the first two unification parts. I would have liked to have seen more time spent with the Vulcans and the Romulans and the Romulo-Vulcans. And, you know, instead of just seeing the leaders of these factions, kind of seeing a little bit more about the divisions within these factions, because it just sort of felt like, okay, these people are together now, you know, mm-hmm. And it's sort of slapdash. Of course, this happened centuries before and you're in a time of conflict, but it begs the question for us, the audience, like, well, how did they ever come together in the first place? Who are the forces that are fighting for this? Who are the people on the ground in this society that, you know, are Romulo Vulcans who benefit from this society keeping together? And that's the sort of thing that older Trek would have at least taken maybe 5 minutes to do. And newer Trek doesn't seem to take that time. So it's well intended. You can see that that's kind of where they were aiming, but they never quite hit the mark.
Mm-hmm. So that actually brings up an interesting point here. We're talking new Trek and obviously old Trek here kind of coming together in this sort of unification of story. And it seems that in today's film and television, it's become much more shorthanded. Our character interactions are quick, sharp, witty. Mm-hmm. And we have these moments that are just designed to give us some quick insight into the characters or into the story before we launch into the next action sequence or suspense moment. What I've been seeing with all of the Trek now today is just that they're jamming a lot of story, mm-hmm. a lot more story into these shows than Trek had previously done.
Right.
With possibly the exception of maybe like the animated series. The thing that is overwhelmingly noticeable to me with old Trek is that we spend a lot of time really delving in and getting to know these characters, getting a feel for who these people are.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it's necessarily a matter of we've only seen like 30-something episodes of Discovery.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when you compare that to 26 episodes of Voyager or 20-something episodes of Deep Space Nine, so it was 24 for the first season, something mm-hmm. like that. And then 26 for TNG. Mm-hmm. You know, forget TOS, just even more recent stuff. We know who these characters are.
Right.
And their backstory. I wonder how much are we really getting to know these characters besides their Lieutenant so-and-so or Ensign right. so-and-so. Like, why are they on the ship? Why are they in Starfleet? Are they from Earth? We don't even know.
Right. I think the one thing, as we were talking about Discovery, we know that Owosakun is from a colony of Luddites, but we right. don't know how that influenced her perspective, how that influenced her life. By this point in, let's say, for example, the third season of TNG, we're fully aware that Riker was pretty much raising himself by the age of 15, has mm-hmm. a rough relationship with his dad, and you can see how that influences his character. He drives himself, pushes himself to be the best at whatever it is he does. He loves the challenge of doing things because, you know, you get the psychology of it. He's basically constantly trying to appease a never appeasable father. But you don't know how the past lives of many of the bridge crew characters in some of the new Trek influences it. And I'll be specific to Discovery, because I feel like Picard took the time to flesh out each of its characters, their backstories, and their motivations. On Discovery, we have the brilliant performances from Sinequa, brilliant performances from most of the major cast, but you look at the rest of the bridge crew, we just now found out kernels of information about Detmer. We get pieces of information here and there about our side characters, and I know we've talked again offline about how it seems on Discovery, if you get an episode that focuses on your character, you're gonna die, or you're gonna be written off the show in some fashion.
Right, right. It's almost like a reverse red shirt.
Right. Yeah. It's a reverse red shirt. The red shirts, you never knew who they were, and they were gone quickly. Now they're there forever, but you still don't know who they are until they're gone. And you can always get a feel for when Trek is made by people who love it versus people who don't really get it. Mm-hmm. With the possible exception of Nick Meyer, you know, someone who came in cold to Trek and gave us Wrath of Khan. But it seems like with new Trek, you get the feel of people who they either grew up with it, some version of it, and they love it. They heard about it and they loved what it was about, but never really got into it, versus people who are, this is just a job. Mm-hmm. So it feels like the franchise of Star Trek exists both in reality and not in reality to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
There is a real world Star Trek franchise to it to a certain extent, and that's the fan interaction, the cast, the crews that all work together on it. So all of that's to say, Jeff Russo, as someone who loves Star Trek and is contributing to it, Michael Giacchino, who's also loves Star Trek and is contributing to it, is some of the things that are making this new generation so much better, so much able to get over some of the humps we might complain about, but also get us to the stuff that we love.
And that's an interesting point that you made. I just was thinking about this while you were talking. We're in an era now of Star Trek where new writers are coming into it with nowhere near the amount of canon as mm-hmm. they did 25 years ago. So you started off writing for Star Trek The Next Generation in season one or two. You had 80 episodes of original series and four films.
Mm-hmm.
and maybe the animated series, depending on if you wanted to count it. And the one, you know, wonderful thing that Gene did in developing Next Generation is he said it 78 years in the future and specifically said, hey, if we don't even mention the original cast or any of that business in the show, that's fine. This show should stand on its own. So now we've entered a completely different era where we now have, we had going into Discovery 700 plus episodes of Star Trek. And so now we're looking at a time where there's so much Trek out there. There's Wikipedia, there's Memory Alpha, there's all types of ways that we can look up and reference things so that we as fans can feel as if there's, you know, all the details are staying consistent or we're verifying the details that used to just kind of slip.
Right.
And my thought is, we talk about like the exception of Nick Meyer, but is it really that Trek today is just working with writers who just have so much more canon at their fingertips? And that is part of the struggle in the writer's room?
That's a very good question. You know, I would love to talk to some of the Discovery writers about, or, you know, even the people who worked on Picard or the people who are going to be working on Strange New Worlds or, even on Lower Decks, and just to see, like, is canon a, is it a shackle for you? Does it tie you to a bunch of stuff that you don't want to have to deal with, that you'd rather let the story take you where you want to go? Or is the canon, is it just like a grab bag of candy that you can, you know, throw into the script? And then you get into the tricky part where there are different types of Star Trek fans, aren't there? There are the fans that, you know, the references are just candy and you're in it for whatever this story is, whatever this version of Trek is. And then there's the Star Trek fan that you need to adhere to the timelines, to the histories, who was, you know, where this character was in the universe on this star date and this star date, how much technology had advanced by that point, and extrapolate from there if you're going into the future. And it's got to be a tightrope to walk between those two lines. But as you mentioned before, that had to have been a much harder tightrope, even by the Voyager era, as opposed to now. But they didn't have Memory Alpha. They didn't have all these internet sources. I think, you know, we joked offline, if Lin-Manuel Miranda can look on Wikipedia, find the lyrics in Jabba the Hutt's language and write a song, I don't see why Star Trek canon can be that difficult. It, you know, like, it's not that hard to just slip in one thing about Klingons that we know. And the truth of the matter is, with Lower Decks, they're very good at that. They're very good as the references as fun candy. And you can appreciate that kind of Star Trek, or at least I can, because it doesn't betray the canon. It doesn't betray what Star Trek is. It just has fun with what we all know, what we've all seen. But then you have some of these other stories that sort of, they pick something out of canon, and it's as if they don't really know what to do with it because they never examined what that thing meant in canon. And I feel like that's where the writers may be struggling with, because it feels like, yeah, you can pick something out of canon, but you really need to look up what that means, what the significance of that thing is. Yeah, the Klingon D7 battle cruiser looks cool, but you can't just drop it in anywhere, you know, without some context, without it meaning, you know, without the meaning that's attached to it.
Right. One of the things I was doing prior to us beginning this podcast, I read Gene Roddenberry's authorized biography that came out around 30 years ago, right after his death. One of the things I found quite fascinating about it was that Gene didn't seem to care too much about the technobabble being in the show or not. He just cared that the technobabble had consistency to it. And I think there's a certain elegance to that as far as story. If the technobabble is repeated and repeated and repeated, and it has certain meanings and certain contexts that are created, then as the audience, you take it to understand to mean things, and there adds a layer of believability to the show.
Right.
That was something he was very attached to, was believability through just the repeated use of creative science, if you will.
Right. I'm going to make a reference to another franchise, and it's one I know you're not the biggest fan of, but I kind of enjoy it. It's Doctor Who. And
I knew it was coming.
the first actor who played Doctor Who, William Hartnell, and of course, pretty much everybody treated this like this is just some rinky-dink Saturday afternoon kids show about history. But William Hartnell, he had a series of movements that he did when he's operating the TARDIS. You press this, and so whenever somebody would to come along, you'd be like, no. You press this button and then you pull this lever. Then you come around here, turn this. It didn't matter that it was just this, you know, little kid show about history. It was the consistency of it. If he was going to be doing it repeatedly, and if he needed to be believed as this character operating the ship, then he needed to do it the same way each time.
I know Will Wheaton has spoken often about when he was Ensign Crusher on the bridge of the Enterprise. He had an imagined layout of everywhere every control was and every sequence of buttons, what they would do. That certain movements, certain parts of the keypad were designed to take the ship into warp. Whether this was to turn the ship around. So that it had a consistency of him just tapping on a console that we can't ever see the readout on.
Yeah, now, you know, what would be fun would be to find out, and I wonder if anybody's asked them about this on the, if Will has ever asked them on Ready Room or anything like that, if the cast and crew have like certain movements that they consistently repeat for certain things for Discovery. Yeah. Or for Picard, you know, you kind of get the feeling that they probably had to, because you have this, they had the holographic interface sort of a thing, so they'd have to be some relative consistency in their movements. But I'd be curious as to whether or not, you know, do you literally just put your fingers in the air and wiggle them around and we'll do it in post? Or is it, you know, do they have something that they say, we do it this way for, you know, Engage or for, you know, whatever the action may be?
Are the writers drawing from personality traits of prior Trek, or are they drawing on altogether new personality traits that we've never seen before?
Now, I just from like interviews and things that I've seen, I think it was maybe like Star Trek. It was either Star Trek Day or maybe during their virtual Comic-Con. If you're listening to this outside of the year 2020, it was a crap show and we had to do everything virtually. So it was in one interview where I think the character Tindy, who's played by Noah Wells, they kind of shaped that character based upon her personality. But I remember specifically from one episode of Lower Decks where we see some Andorian characters and they are paranoid. I started with you have the character who's based on, you know, who the characters are based on. So it felt like they go towards canon unless they have a reason not to. And that may be the performer, that may be the story they need to tell for that character, whatever it may be.
And that's the kind of story that you would say Lower Decks is telling, is they're trying to tell new twists on canon stories.
I think they're taking the stories that we've seen in Star Trek before and sending them up, but not sarcastically, but lovingly. It's sort of like almost a loving roast, but at the same time, you know, as soon as the jokes are over, they kind of give you a hug and say, we love you, kid. You know, that sort of thing. I feel like that's what Lower Decks is doing.
You know, we look at Picard and it looks like, is that trying to be a continuity of canon? Are they trying to, like, what is Picard's angle with canon?
I think Picard's angle with canon, it feels like it goes far deeper into a much more emotional and character-based story. You know, we might spend quite a few more minutes out of a Star Trek show, out of your average Star Trek show, talking about how a character feels than we do seeing action. Correct me where I'm wrong, but there's the story of Ronald D. Moore when he wrote the episode Family for TNG. And he takes it to Roddenberry. Roddenberry hated the idea. There's no action in it. You know, they decide to tinker with it and send it out, you know, produce it anyway. So I feel like Picard is a little bit more, if you could compare it to any TNG or any other Star Trek, it's a little bit more like that episode Family, in which we spend a little bit more time, and it's still engaging. It's still great acting. It's still great performance. And of course, you can't spend, you know, you can't do the Merchant Ivory version of Star Trek the entire time. So you got to have some lasers and shoot them up there. But it feels like Picard is much more, I wouldn't diminish it by just calling it prestige drama Trek, but I would say it's much more focused on character. Characters drive the plot. Not so much like the need for adventure or your family is the center of every single thing that happens in the universe. Sorry, Discovery.
Yeah. And I guess it comes back to like the backgrounds of the writers. You have Akiva Goldsman and Michael Chabon that were showrunning Picard season one. And they had some other wonderfully talented people. I think Kirsten Beyer was in the room as well. You get this story, this 10-episode story for a season that, if you never, and I hope this doesn't happen, but if you never had a season two of Picard, you have a complete story.
Right.
You don't feel like, oh, they cheated me out and I have to wait till, you know, next season to get the answer to something that was super crucial to understanding this plot. So you don't have that. You also feel like you, at the end of it, the moments when they're together on the bridge of La Serena, you feel like these are characters that actually have a bond to each other.
Right.
There actually is things that connect them. You know what their hopes are. You know what their fears are. These are basic character things.
Right.
And Chabon comes specifically not only as a Trek fan himself, but he comes as a very talented novelist. And you could almost say that Picard, season one, sort of has the structure of a novel.
That's an interesting take. I had never considered, but you're right. It's almost as if you could write a novel about Picard's last days and film it, that very much is what Picard feels like. And you're absolutely right. It has a beginning, it has a middle, it has an end. Would you like to see more? Absolutely. But if for some reason, knock on wood, cross our fingers, throw salt over your shoulder, whatever you got to do, we never get a season two of Picard, at least we got a complete story. And this may just have to do more with television, I think, more so than just Star Trek, because I feel like Discovery is the victim of something that a lot of TV shows were the victim of, and that is the Game of Thrones curse. And it is this idea that you have to have this overarching storyline. You have to have these threads that go from this season to this season. And look where that got you. You can't, you know, you string people along for so long. You have these overarching storylines, and then it's completely unrewatchable because you can't watch a single episode without watching a dozen episodes.
One of the things that's interesting to me is Picard followed, basically a year and a half after Discovery, a year after Discovery released. And we saw a remarkable difference in the way that storytelling was structured. And, you know, you look at even the pilot, the first episode of Picard, and all the things that the previews had kind of hinted at, almost all the big questions that you had going into that pilot got answered in the pilot.
Yeah. They really did.
You didn't, you know, because after Discovery, the first season or two of Discovery, you start to get this feeling of, okay, so there's this new era of storytelling, not just Star Trek, where like Lost was sort of the originator of,
right?
Where in science fiction storytelling, we're going to have a moment. It's going to go up to this point. Now we're gonna, instead of having the commercial break like we normally would, it's the end of the episode.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and now we're stretched out 12 episodes to get an answer to something. You know, currently we're in what, episode 8?
Right.
Of Discovery of season 3, and right now, I mean, you can speculate, but we still don't know what the burn is all about.
We don't know what exactly it is, how it started. And my issue with the long form storytelling is this, is that not every story deserves 12 episodes. Okay, not every story arc deserves to be long form, not even 3 episodes even. And I feel like sometimes these storylines are just stretched out for the sake of filler. On the flip side of that, of course, the days where you have your one and done episode where things are addressed this one time and never discussed again, you know, nobody ever comes along and asks Dr. Crusher like, hey, so are you completely over the fact that you had sex with a ghost who also had sex with your grandmother? We just don't talk about it ever again. You know, those.
Correct. No one should.
Right. No one should discuss that. That definitely does not deserve 3-4 episodes. But of course, we can't go back to the days where something major happens to a character and we never discuss it again until, you know, maybe 6 episodes. At the same time, I don't want an entire season where every single episode is about Worf's discommendation from the Klingon Empire. There has to be a middle of the road. I think that, and again, this is all hoping with the speculation that Strange New Worlds kind of fulfills that middle point where, yeah, you have mostly one and done episodes, but there are some character arcs that are continuing on in the background or as B or C plots. But you don't get a lot of that in Discovery. Everything is for the A plot. Everything drives the A plot. The side characters in some of the new Trek, again, with the exception of Picard, which is a self-contained story. With Discovery, they keep dragging these stories out. They keep dragging these character arcs out, but you still never get a sense of who they are.
I've spent some time in a writer's room working on different projects over the years. And what's interesting is in a writer's situation, for those of you who have not been involved in the way a television show or a visual medium project is developed, but you'll sit in a room with, you know, 4, 5, 8 other people trying to figure out the overarching plot points, plot moments, beats of a season or a movie, I don't know, and you want to hit all these different beats. And sometimes I feel like there was a lot of time spent laying out these plot points on some Trek shows, and other times there wasn't any time spent with that because it was decided that we're going to make the points on the road about the characters, not the story. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where the difference is. I think it may even, you know, go back to Michael Piller's days of show running The Next Generation. And it's like there's that distinct change in Next Generation where it stops becoming 60-minute self-contained stories, mm-hmm. really, but it stops becoming, you know, a plot about this science fiction element or whatever, and it starts becoming about these characters facing these obstacles with a science fiction element. Mm-hmm. And then I was just going to say that, you know, when we look at Discovery and we're talking about Picard as well, it feels like Discovery is written where we wrote a map of story plot points and the character elements are filled in where they can feel like it. Mm-hmm. And Picard, it's written from the moment of, hey, we're going to put the character arcs on the board and we're going to fill in the story.
Yeah. And that honestly, I've read online criticisms of Picard to a certain extent for that. Like I said, that's that split between Trekker fans. I feel like there are some who are more story and character invested, and there are some who are more canon and technology invested. Neither is wrong, but you have a project like Picard that kind of plays a little bit loose and fast with a little bit of the canon or some of the technology in favor of servicing the story about this character, this man and his journey. Whereas you have Discovery, and yeah, they service the plot. The characters come second. A lot of the canon is stuff that we're familiar with Star Trek comes second. So with season 3 of Discovery, it feels like they've moved character a little bit further up the list, but with still that same order.
Obviously, this is our first episode, so hopefully as the show gets along, mm-hmm. you'll hear more of our comments in real time as opposed to us talking about in the past. But, you know, it's been a criticism that you and I, it seems we've both shared, is that there's been so much of a centrism of the plot mm-hmm. around a single character that it feels like the whole world revolves around the character, and it's been brought up the whole Mary Sue mm-hmm. You know, cliche, the Mary Sue cliche, we'll just say that. And you know, we get again and again, it's the Mary Sue saves the Enterprise, and it can be a guy. We're not, in this case, it just happens to be a woman in the case of Michael Burnham. Mm-hmm. But you know there were some accusations, of course, a while back that could be applied to Wesley Crusher. Mm-hmm. And in fact, that even is magnified when you consider that the character was named after Gene Roddenberry. Mm-hmm. And so was this Gene Roddenberry sort of like allowing himself to save the Enterprise?
Right. We've talked a lot about some of our issues with the character Michael Burnham. And I you know, it is kind of a difficult thing. Like, the argument could be made that other characters in Star Trek are Mary Sue's. That's not an argument I want to get into or start picking out characters so, you know, we can fight about it or whatever, whatever. Just for like a little bit of context on that argument, there are some people who say, well, you know, that was Mary Sue as applied to several other males in Star Trek. You may look at Kirk as a Mary Sue. Debatable. You may look at Sisko as a Mary Sue. I mean, he was an emissary for gods, for goodness sake. Mm-hmm. And literally had, I think, two major conflicts solved by Deus Ex Machina, literally. So, you know, there are criticisms that could be made for other male characters. And it's fair to say that sometimes those criticisms aren't lobbed at them as much as they are lobbed at Michael Burnham. Mm-hmm. That said, there are some fair criticisms to make for Michael Burnham. It feels like the entire crew of Discovery is just like, oh, that's Michael. She'll run off and do whatever the hell she wants as long as she thinks it's right. Yes, there are many other characters in Star Trek who are like that. Who have done things like that. We've always gotten a sense of major consequences, though. One thing I would like to stress, though, is that the issues with Michael Burnham, well, let me put it to you like this. I'll just say that Sonequa Martin-Green is an incredible performer. So whatever direction Michael Burnham takes, she can play it. And that's the brilliance of her. I almost hate that Discovery is not in a time frame where they could interact with Picard. I've said this off screen. She could hold her own against Sir Patrick Stewart. So I would really love to see Michael Burnham's character have a firm direction, as opposed to, especially in the current season three, where she appeared to be sort of at odds with herself. And now after this trial in Unification 3, she's reset. I feel like that's a little bit easy, and it kind of does a disservice to the performance. Like, if your character just needed, you know, your mom to talk some sense into you and then everything is fine, I mean, yeah, you can go that route, but that's, I don't know if that's typical of Star Trek. Do you think things are, it feels like they set up something really complex and then gave it a really simple solution.
The thing that strikes me now with season three of Discovery is that we're in a season of a show where all these characters have sacrificed so much to be there.
Yeah.
To be in that 32nd century. And we saw so much about them having to bond and unify, like all this stuff with Saru having to have a movie night at the shuttle bay. And of course, as we've joked many times before, that shuttle bay is the death trap of the ship.
It never closes.
One power outage, one power fluctuation, and that's it. The show's over.
We learned that there was an episode of TNG where there was it was some sort of virus. Sorry.
Disaster.
Disaster
was the leaking canisters, and then Geordi and Beverly are inside this shuttle bay.
Oh no, I was thinking of another episode where it's one with Dr. Pulaski, and she has to figure out a way to get some children who are infected with a virus onto a ship so she can examine them. And she's saying, like, well, why can't you just erect a force field? And they go, if that force field closes or collapses for even a second due to a power fluctuation, you're all dead.
Mm-hmm.
So
right. A natural selection, that's the episode title.
That's it. Thank you. So I saw that episode of the movie night where they're all in the cargo bay and the doors are open. I'm like, if that power fluctuates for even a second, you just killed your whole crew. For movie night, dude.
Yeah, and that was, and when you think about it, also Next Generation, sort of keeping the continuity of technology, that was 24th century technology. So we're 70, 80 years, 90 years before Picard's era, and it's just gonna fly around the galaxy without the shuttle bay door down.
Yeah.
I mean, there's not really any story or plot element, but it's—I don't know—it almost kind of makes me wonder how many times I don't know about you, but when I watch scenes that happen in the shuttle bay and I see that door open, I just keep waiting for a surprise moment where that shuttle bay just decompresses.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's no different from you're driving down the freeway and you see somebody who has like a Jeep back, you know, the door is open, you know, it's completely up in the air. The whole back is open. You're like, I don't know how you don't feel the effects of the environment around you with that door completely open, but like, it's probably not safe for you or anybody else. And maybe this is just something that we as Trekkers, it just sort of stands out. That said, it just shut the door. Just all you have to do is just put a digital, like, just shut the door. Just shut the door.
Yeah, you've got too much of the audience waiting for something bad to happen.
Right.
So here's something I was thinking also about. So Discovery jumped ahead to 32nd century, and a lot of speculation and conversations gone into the idea that by moving to the 32nd century, it's allowed them to not be a slave to canon. And here we are now talking about this upcoming series, Strange New Worlds.
Mm-hmm.
And while it's going into a format of episodic 60-minute episode storytelling type of thing that, you know, fans have been asking for, it's once again putting Star Trek in a position of – it's kind of a prequel.
Yeah.
It's now having to wedge itself and fight canon.
You know, I think that Strange New Worlds is in a different position for a couple of different reasons. Number one, Discovery had to be the first out of the gate. So it had to serve every master there was. It had to be new Trek. It had to be classic Trek. It had to be, it had to be Trek for people who had never seen Trek before. It had to be Trek for diehard fans. I think that it's pulled away from needing to feel that way, but at the same time, it still has this feeling of we have to be everything to everyone. Strange New Worlds, I think, has the opportunity to not serve the new Trek or necessarily the casual fan demographic. And I think it's going to rely more on the built-in fan base that knows of Star Trek. Where now, as it pertains to canon, obviously, if you expect your fan base to be built in and already familiar, then that's a good thing. At the same time, if you don't have to reinvent the wheel, then again, you get back to canon is an Easter egg. Canon is candy. You get to play with it. You get to use it how you want, but you're not necessarily a slave to it. But it does kind of paint itself into a corner because there's only so many things that you can do because you're limited by what we knew of the original series. I personally feel like Strange New Worlds, there's still a lot of opportunities with there where you can play with canon, but not be a slave to it. Like when they announced Strange New Worlds, I started thinking to myself, okay, they can do cool things like who did first contact with the Cardassians? You know, it's a race that's known to canon, but you can play with it because we never saw them in that time frame. We never heard of them in that time frame. You can exist within the penumbra of the rest of the canon that we knew of without betraying what we know.
The question also is with something like Strange New Worlds, the beautiful, I mean, it's right there built in the title. Is this show going to also potentially take on the baton of saying, hey, we're in this era where they're exploring strange new worlds, and we're going to see things in Star Trek. We're going to have strange phenomena in the galaxy or on this planet, or we're going to beam down to a planet and see some strange, interesting culture. It seems like in New Trek, like if we look at Picard, everywhere they've gone has kind of already been explored.
Right.
Like there's not a planet where that's like, oh, you know, man has not been there before. Mm-hmm. Humanity hasn't been there. The Federation hasn't been there. The Romulans haven't been there. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, they're on a Borg cube. Well, we've been on a Borg cube before.
Right.
You go on Discovery. It's like, okay, we get every now and then we get like the Kelpian home planet. Mm-hmm. We get these other planets, but usually they're occupied by, you know, telekinetic beings that float in space. And that's not really the focus of the story. Mm-hmm. There's other things. And they happen to be at this planet because of a clue, mm-hmm. or because they need to grab something from there or somebody from there. Mm-hmm. When I look at Strange New Worlds, is that what we're going to see for the first time, I think, since like the days of Enterprise and Voyager?
I agree. And I'll add on to that and say I think that one thing that New Trek seems to be absolutely terrified of doing is tackling our current world, our current geopolitical issues, which to me when I was younger, that's one of the things that attracted me to Star Trek. One of my favorite of the films is Undiscovered Country. Why? Because it's practically the fall of the Soviet Union. And those parallels and the way they played that fascinated me. You don't get that in New Trek anymore. And I get it's tricky to draw a line in the sand and say, this is where my progressivism is, just mm-hmm. because, you know, you're always going to whatever line on either side, you know, there are going to be people who oppose you on either side of that line, even if they agree with some of what you say. I think it's possible to do morality tales. And let's be honest, that's what the 1960s stories really were. These were sci-fi Aesop, I think I heard someone say at one point. These were morality tales often about how do we deal with our current world. They weren't criticisms of Soviet policy or American policy, and it didn't have to get into those weeds. It never did. But you could still tell it was making a direct reference to one thing or another. That continued in TNG. And even in Deep Space Nine, if you want to look at the situation between the Bajorans and the Cardassians, I can't think of anything in New Trek that just put its flag in the air and said, this is where we are. With the possible exception of Blue Del Barrio, Adira, they came out as non-binary, non-gendered. That was, and we've discussed this, and we can probably go into detail in this moment in another podcast, but I think that that is the one moment in Discovery where I felt like, yeah, that's the one thing that they've tackled that actually had anything to do with the world that we currently live in. The mm-hmm. rest are way more thinly if there's something I'm missing, it felt like it was way thickly veiled. And granted, we don't have to be quite as heavy-handed as Let That Be Your Last Battlefield, but I feel like Strange New Worlds is probably, or at least I hope, is going to take a little bit more risk in discussing the door out, you know, the world outside of our window and using Star Trek as a parallel
fashion.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
Funny, we're coming back to talking about the original series here, and we started this podcast recording talking about Unification 3 and the title meaning of that. Mm-hmm. And something that is interesting to me when I look at the titles of these episodes today is they're related to something in the episode themselves, of course, but the beauty of the titles themselves, I miss it. I miss the beauty of such wonderful titles of that original series going back to that. Like, you know, For the World is Hollow and I Touch the Sky.
Yeah, yeah. I think the one episode of Discovery that reminded me of that was An Oboe for Charon. And I'm like, oh, mm-hmm. that's a beautiful title. That's a really
And that was a good episode.
Yeah, it was a really good episode.
So we judge the episode by the titles. Hey, yeah. Hold on. That one doesn't look like – that's a pretty generic title. Eh.
This podcast is now Title Trek.
Yeah, I mean, like you go back to it. You have Balance of Terror.
Let's see. Let's go back to some of the wonderful titles of Trek.
Plato's Stepchildren.
Oh, my goodness. That's a good one.
You know, Bread and Circuses.
Amok Time. Yeah. Just the flow of the words there. Amok Time. You could have said that exact same phrase in so many different ways, but those two words phrased together and then spelled together, it just draws you in.
Yeah. The best of both worlds, if we want to go Next Generation.
Best of both worlds.
But that's actually an example, strangely enough, since we were talking about unification and the purpose of that title. Mm-hmm. You look at the title that they ended up using for Best of Both Worlds. What about that title is indicative in that episode? Like, where does that come from?
That's a good question. Like, none of what happened to Picard, who was in both worlds, was the best of anything.
It's a reference from Candide by Voltaire.
French.
And as I understand it, there was a very different plot to that episode.
Oh,
I think it may have just been a situation where the title just stuck, even though the story completely changed. Funny thing is, you know, we're talking about all these spinoffs that we have from the original series. Mm. We talk about, are they really Trek? You know, we keep coming back to that. Are they really Trek? Mm. And when we go back, and this is sort of my like final food for thought here on this whole thing. The first spinoff to Star Trek actually came in 1968. And here we are today talking about Voyager. We're talking about a ship being lost in the Delta Quadrant. Mm-hmm. We're talking about Deep Space Nine and a wormhole and the Dominion and the wars, you know, and Discovery and the Spore Drive and jumping to the 32nd century. You know, as much as we're talking about what comes the closest to old Star Trek, there's that failed spinoff series of 1968, and the pilot episode was, of course, Assignment Earth. That had no starships planned in it. It was going to be about a time-traveling character with his cat, this James Bond of time-traveling.
Right, and his executive assistant, played by Gary Gar. Right.
And we have that whole story going on there, and that was going to be the first spinoff to Star Trek. People are like, oh, well, Picard can't be Star Trek because there's not much of it like traveling from planet to planet. Discovery can't be it because there's so much about like strange fantastical things and time travel and influencing the past and the future. And then we go back and we look at like, what are the two spinoffs of Star Trek that Roddenberry himself worked on? Assignment Earth mm-hmm. and The Next Generation. And so I think it really says that there's such a diversity to what Star Trek can be. And it doesn't have to just be hurtling through space on a ship or spinning on a space station. And as much criticism as that got.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's an excellent point to make. And I guess this will kind of be my final thought. And you're absolutely right. There truly aren't very many limits to what Trek can be. We thought that it was you're on a ship, you're flying through space, you're going to different worlds. But Deep Space Nine proved that it doesn't necessarily have to be that. You can do all different sorts of things. It doesn't have to be just a drama. It can be a comedy. It can be action. It can be suspense. So there was one episode where Captain Picard is Bruce Willis from Die Hard. You can tackle any genre in Star Trek. So what is it about these stories that tell us this is Trek?
Story Trek is brought to you by no one at this time. If you want to follow this podcast, we should have a Twitter handle up at some point with Story Trek. You can follow us on there and interact with us. If you have any questions you want us to follow up on and comment on in any of these episodes, that's be the place you could reach us. And in the meanwhile, I'm Michael Stratigakis.
I'm Marshall Hopkins, LLAP.
Signing off.